From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua, via Skype on Monday. So, let's first do an update with Bolivia and then scan the terrain because there's, as usual, a lot going on. In fact, an unusual amount given the election in Uruguay and people in the streets all over the place.
Right. Yeah, in Bolivia, if you remember when we had an earlier conversation about the events in Bolivia, and my comments was that this was a historic moment, and that the right wing would have to decide whether they were going to go back to massacring the general population that was protesting against their coup regime, or not. And to begin with, it looked as though that they were just going to kill as many people as they could in order to try and intimidate the population into dropping the protests and crush opposition to the coup regime that way. And there was a massacre in a place called Sabare near Cochabamba. There was another massacre in Sabare. So in that place it was, and I think they killed a total of 8 people. And in El Alto they killed a total of 9 people with hundreds injured. This is the army, as well as the police. But the thing is that in Bolivia, the popular movements there, the indigenous movements there, the industrial workers movements there, for example, the mining organizations, the mining labor unions, they are very determined, and killing some of them is not going to stop them their protests if they feel really strongly about what they're protesting about.
And they have huge numbers, too. They can overwhelm the army if that's what it comes to.
In a couple of places, they did overwhelm the police.
Right.
What seems to have happened is that the right-wing coup regime, insofar as that's a monolithic thing, which we can talk about a little bit later, perhaps, decided that not only were they, because they were not only facing this massive national protest across the country, blockades of main highways that were preventing basic goods getting into the urban centres, so that the majority of the population in urban centres were beginning to suffer as a result of lack of access to food and gas and all the basics of that people need to live in an urban environment. And so that blockade was extremely effective, as it has been historically for the social movements. But also, politically, there was a problem for the coup regime because they don't control the only institution with any legitimacy now in Bolivia, which is the country's legislature, which is a two-chamber legislature with a Senate and a Chamber of Deputies. And both those chambers are controlled by deputies that are members of the Movement to Socialism.
By two-thirds, by the way. By two-thirds, by the way. They have two-thirds, 67-68% majorities in each of the two houses.
Yeah, so and that is from the previous election. That's from the 2015 the previous election, not this recent election that's just been challenged by the right-wing coup regime. So, although it was perfectly legitimate. So, faced with that, with both the mass mobilization of protests across the country that were making life impossible for a big chunk of the political support for the coup regime, which is the urban middle classes in Bolivia, and also faced with that constitutional obstacle, which is practically insuperable for them unless they're going to arrest all those deputies and lock them up, which is something that they did contemplate doing but seem to have decided against. So faced with those two obstacles, what they seem to have done is negotiated a document first they negotiated with the mass deputies in the legislature over the preparation of a new electoral law that would provide for elections to be held in January 2020, January next year. And that looks that legislation was passed by the legislature, and as I'm not sure if it's been signed by the coup regime president, but what that in effect means is that the legislature has given some legitimacy to the coup regime on the basis that there will be free and fair elections in January.
Right.
So then, and that's a big if. Right, given the levels of repression that continue to be deployed by the coup regime, although part of the agreement that they seem to have made with the legislature is to withdraw the army from the streets.
Right.
And it's not clear if that's been complied with or not. But to some extent, it seems to have been. But then there was another agreement over the last couple of days between organizations, social organizations that support the government of Evo Morales and his MAS party, and also the main labor organization in Bolivia, which is the Central Obrera Boliviana, the COB, of which the miners are the main force in that labor organization. And there are also, according to the report I'm reading, another five sectors from from different parts of Bolivian society that also took part in those negotiations. And of the 15 points that were put forward to the coup regime actually accepted 8 of them. Some of them are extremely favorable to the social movement.
Right.
And if you look at that in particular with regard to labor rights, continuation of no privatization, continuity in the strategic state organizations, the state and state industries, which is kind of another way of saying that they're not going to privatize the nationalized gas industry.
Right.
So, but and there are all those kinds of provisions. But why is the coup regime doing that? It's doing it partly because of what I mentioned, the nationwide mobilization of protests, this huge constitutional problem that they have in terms of trying to give legitimacy to their regime, which is they have to talk to the legislature, which is dominated by Evo Morales' MAS party. But also, in addition to that, one of the reasons that they're negotiating is, according to an analysis and report that I've read elsewhere, there seem to be two main factions within the coup regime. There's the kind of more political faction that's represented by Carlos Mesa, who was the opposition presidential candidate who lost the elections on October the 20th. He lost them by 10%. That's
right.
Well established now.
Right.
Very well established. There was no fraud in those elections.
Right.
But he's in conflict with the kind of more extreme right wing, led by individuals like Luis Camacho, the right wing fascist millionaire from Santa Cruz, which is the third biggest. It occupies a third of Bolivia's national territory. It's a hugely important department in Bolivia politically, and Camacho and his extreme right-wing supporters are pushing for an intensification of the repression, but that seems to be the case, because what they want is in some ways very similar to what happened here in Nicaragua. What the extreme right-wing want is to eliminate MAS in Bolivia. They want to make it impossible for the MAS party to function as a successful political organization in Bolivia. And that's very similar to what happened here in Nicaragua in 2018. What the objective of the right wing back in the attempted coup in 2018 was to destroy support for the Frente Sandinista, Well, it's very difficult to destroy support, which is represented by about 2 million people, right? And they have the same population, the same problem in Bolivia. And in the Massa party has around 40% solid support in Bolivia. So the attempt by the extreme right wing to kind of deal a knockout blow that completely eliminates mass as a political force in Bolivia is doomed to failure. And the moderate right-wing opposition to the mass party in Bolivia recognize that. And that they also recognize that they have no chance of establishing any legitimacy for the coup regime if they don't organize elections within the next 90 days as the constitution provides for. And so what they seem to have done is on the basis of that internal conflict plus the external reality of the nationwide protests and the constitutional obstacle that they have of having to deal with a mass-dominated legislature, that's led them to engage in these agreements that are extremely favorable to the social movements and to mass and the opposition in general to the coup regime. And on the part of the protest movement against the coup regime, their priority has been to pacify the country and stop the repression, or stop the worst violence of the repression. Because it's very clear, as we've seen over the last couple of days, to different incidents where mass party leaders have been locked up, and the vice president of the party and the transparency secretary, the party has a transparency secretary, they've both been locked up by the coup regime authorities. So, you know, one of the strands of the recent agreement is the release of people that have been detained by the police during the protests against the coup regime. And so the next few days we'll only know over the next few days whether that agreement is going to be honored or not. But things look much more favorable for the protests against the coup regime and much less favorable for the coup regime than they did even a week ago.
You know, we're learning also as this plays out. I mean, we saw plenty of evidence of it, for example, in the composition of the legislature and the annual, or not the annual, but the, you know, the periodic presidential election results and municipal election results. But the situation in Bolivia is different from the situation in places like Brazil and Argentina, even Nicaragua. I mean, sorry, even Venezuela, where you have a pretty even split in the electoral population. You know, the voters come in within 3-4% of each other, and so you know, if you have a popular socialist candidate like Lula, for example, he can win, but if you have someone who's not quite as well known, he or she can lose. And you know, there's a certain amount of cachet that goes with the name that can make it over the short spread between the two factions. That's not the case in Bolivia. We're seeing that the social movements hold sway with a lot and a lot of power with a large portion of the population. Again, you mentioned that they've overwhelmed the police on a few occasions already. The way the power configuration rolled out in Bolivia is you had the military and the security forces more or less leading the coup on the ground. And, you know, you can do a takeover like that if you can intimidate the population, but the population can overwhelm you if you misgauge your power in a situation like that. And it appears that they seem to be adjusting for that possibility now.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I think that's a common. We've seen it in Nicaragua, we've seen it in Venezuela, and now we've seen it in Bolivia. What the right wing do is they kind of try and create an explosive burst of right wing blitzkrieg energy, and that has a tremendous impact for about a week or 2 weeks, and then once the psychological effect of that tremendous blast of right-wing energy dissipates, then they face the reality, right, which hasn't changed.
Right.
The underlying, they make this huge effort to change the reality, and the reality never goes away. And what they do achieve for the few weeks that they're able to hold the initiative is that they destroy the economy.
Right.
And that's happened in Venezuela and Nicaragua, and it's now happening in Bolivia as well.
They steal whatever's not nailed down, right? That right away, right up front.
Right, and what that does is it shocks people, but people see what the right wing have done, and in any free and fair election, there's no way that the right wing are going to win in Bolivia.
Right.
Right, and so the question is, how are they going to cope with that reality?
Yep.
Because it's very clear that they have no chance of winning the next election if it's held under in a free and fair way.
Well, it looks now like they may be making moves to try to do a Lula or a Cristina on Evo Morales. They're talking about prosecuting him for a variety of different things. They haven't been able to find any believable corruption charges yet, but because
they're basing it on a phone call,
right,
that they recorded,
right,
of somebody allegedly talking to Evo Morales.
Right.
That's the basis of the
right.
Right. There's absolutely no
right
concrete of the claim. It's just this.
Right.
This weird video of somebody talking on the phone to somebody who's supposed to be Evo Morales.
Right.
But in any case, that completely misses the point, and it shows just how inept,
right, yeah,
and on fundamentals the right wing are. Because Evo Morales, I think we said this in a previous conversation, it's kind of a historical accident that Evo Morales happens to be at the head of this tremendously powerful and deeply rooted indigenous and campesino movement, right, to achieve basic rights for Bolivia's impoverished majority. And right, and the fact that he's in Mexico and the protests have still managed to roll back the coup, which they have, how far yet remains to be seen. That shows that whenever Morales said that he isn't important, because what's important is the movement that he and his comrades in the mass party, right, have created over the last 20 years.
That's right.
And as he put it, that any new elections will be a chance for a new generation of the mass leadership to come to the fore.
Right.
And so, from their point of view, the Morales isn't running is beside the point.
Right. That's right. Hey, it's an interesting time for that. It's been, I think, today, yesterday, the 25th was the third anniversary of the passing of Fidel Castro. And Cuba seems to be doing fine. There was a complete continuity in terms of the structures of the society. There's no crisis of leaderlessness or any of that, and I think that shows that when you have these basically the societies are created in their roots with the people, that the institutions are durable.
Yeah, and you can see the difference between somewhere like Cuba, and somewhere like Chile, and because what the right wing in Chile achieved back in the 1970 coup, what the right wing want to do in Bolivia.
Right.
They wiped out the left wing opposition. They engaged in mass murder. They physically eliminated thousands of people that constituted the left wing opposition in Chile.
Right.
And then subsequently, it was like complete scorched earth. And in political terms, they just wiped out the political terrain of all their enemies, right? And then they co-opted the Social Democrats. And so that's what the right wing want to do in Nicaragua. It's what they want to do in Venezuela. It's what they tried to do in Bolivia.
Right.
But that just shows you that the right wing can wipe out a whole generation of left wing opposition. But what are they going to do when the new generation turns up and starts being active on the streets and active politically in national life as they are now? And you can see what happens.
Right.
And Piñera's supporters dropped to the Sebastián Piñera, the Chilean president, his supporters dropped to around 8%. And you can see something similar happening in Colombia. Back in the 1980s and the 1990s, the right wing wiped out the left wing political opposition represented in the Unión Patriótica Party. And that made it extremely difficult. And now when I say wiped out, I'm talking about thousands of people that were murdered.
Yeah.
And so in both Chile and in Colombia, you had this phenomenon of the right wing wiping out, murdering wholesale, the left-wing opposition in their countries.
Right.
And so obviously the effect of that is to make it extremely difficult for a progressive left-wing alternative to establish itself again within a generation.
Yeah.
But here what you see now in Colombia, you're seeing mass demonstrations in Colombia, mass demonstrations in Chile, and they can't, the right wing can't get away in the current regional context, they can't get away with murdering another few thousand leftists to make sure that only the right-wing agenda prevails.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in Chile, it was September 11th, 1973, the actual coup, and in about 13 months it took before the institutions were reformed and Pinochet formally took power and Nixon formally recognized them. In other words, they went on a killing spree for about a year. And when the dust settled, the junta became the government. And that was basically the case until the plebiscite in 88 and even really many years after that.
No. And the when did Pinochet die? 2005? And as long as he was alive, he was kind of like a dead hand on Chile's national political life.
Yes, he was.
And it's interesting in Argentina, and look what happened in Argentina. You had a similar effect there. When did the military dictatorship end there? 1983, just after the Malvinas War. And it took a long time, because there in Argentina, 30,000 people were killed. Just think about that. 30,000 people were murdered by the military dictatorship in Argentina. And so, it took a long time for Argentina to develop a progressive alternative. And that progressive alternative only really came to fruition in the governments of Néstor Kirchner and his wife, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, from about 2004-2003 onwards.
Right.
Sure. Now in Argentina, the right wing pulled a kind of public relations stunt back in 2015 to fool people in Argentina that they could somehow overcome the global structural economic obstacles that were making Argentina's economy stagnate. Of course, they had no magic formula.
Right.
And all they did was drive Argentina back into poverty, the worst poverty that they've known for decades.
Right.
And now, as a result of that political failure of the right wing in Argentina to do what they said they'd do, as if they ever could,
right,
there isn't the least chance of it, they're now out of office, and a new progressive government, which includes Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, has won the recent elections by a long way. I know, what was the margin? Something like 9%.
It was a lot. Like, yeah, it was surprisingly large, actually.
Yeah, and in Uruguay, and I think the elections over the weekend, and from in a sense, they were disappointing for people who hold progressive views and support a progressive agenda in Latin America and the Caribbean. But they weren't unexpected, because in Uruguay, the right wing for the first time for many years, and for something like 10, 12, 15 years. And they managed to put together a coalition, because like the right wing in all these countries, they all hate each other, and they can barely tolerate being in the same room with each other.
I know.
But they managed to cobble together a right-wing coalition. In theory, they should have won by 5 or 6% in Sunday's election. But as you and I were discussing in a previous conversation, just because it on paper it looks as though the right wing should walk here, that doesn't mean that that they'll be able to pull it off. And they weren't able to pull it off. And they're now in a technical draw,
right,
that's going to be refereed by the country's electoral authority, in which the margin of advantage for the right-wing candidate, Lacalle Pou, is less than the number of votes that have been challenged in the overall electoral process. You're talking about something like 32,000 to 34,000 votes.
Yep.
So in a country with a voting population of something over 2 million.
Yep.
2.7 million, I think, is the electorate.
Yeah, we're talking about close to about 10% of the, 12% of the vote or something. I mean, I'm sorry, 1% of the vote or 1.2% of the vote, yeah.
Yeah, and it's tiny. And yeah. And so there should be, the electoral authority there have said they will declare results on Thursday or Friday.
Right, but because so you also have outstanding, apparently there were challenges, people purged from the voting rolls and such, like they do in the United States here.
Yeah.
Mostly there were people that seemed like they were trying to filter for people likely to vote for the left. And consequently, those people were allowed to do what would be called here, an alternative ballot. And those are apparently, they were handed out because people insisted on them. And those are being counted. And there may be enough there to swing it, depending on how close it gets. But
it's incredibly close.
Yeah.
And in regional terms, that's a big deal, because if Uruguay goes for a right-wing government, then that'll be another right-wing vote for the United States in the Organization of American States.
Right.
And the other thing that we should definitely mention is that there are elections in the Caribbean island nation of Dominica, I think on December the 6th or December the 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And there too, the OAS has intervened trying to impose an electoral observation mission with the obvious aim of destabilizing the vote there in tiny Dominica. So, and Dominica, in the OAS, each nation has a vote. So if the United States can win Uruguay and destabilize Dominica so they get an amenable government in Dominica, then that'll be two extra votes that they'll have to use against Venezuela and Nicaragua and also Bolivia in the OAS.
Mm. Yeah. there's the whole region seems to be in play, and there's so many countries that where everything pivots, where the population is so evenly divided, even like the United States. I mean, a lot of this is how the nation states were constructed, by the colonials, to have a divided population, so while they're killing each other, you can carry off the gold and the goodies. This has come home to the United States now in one of those chickens roosting scenarios, where even the U.S., the population is divided almost exactly down the middle. And so, it's with the whole region like that, you have what developed over the period beginning with Hugo Chavez, were alternate institutions that, you know, working on a project of integration and national sovereignty and construction and such. And you had the side by side the old architecture of colonialism, basically the Monroe Doctrine and such, OAS, etc. Even these small countries like Dominica can be pivot points for that kind of. Well, we're out of time, so we're going to have to pick this up next week, Tony. And appreciate your time, and we'll speak with you again soon.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now for Community Public Radio. I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.